Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which I record this episode, the Darug and the Burramattagal people. I would like to pay my respects to elders both past, present, and future. On this episode of The Female Drive.
Absolutely. I mean, you could say that F1 racing was Instagram on paper in Formula One back in the day.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Female Drive. My guest on today's show descends from a family of incredibly talented authors, so it's no surprise that when he tells stories, you can't help but be entranced. He has had a lengthy career within the motorsport world, but more specifically F1. Having varied roles throughout his career, from a journalist and editor of some of the top motorsport magazines, to the director of communications for not one, but two F1 teams, he's been front and center for some of the most historic moments of the sport, including Lewis Hamilton's first ever world championship. He is currently the communications director for the Aston Martin Cognizant Racing F1 team, and he managed to fit me in between meetings. Because of this, I knew that we were on a time limit, but he so generously spent much more time with me than I had first anticipated. In all honesty, this interview could have gone for 3 hours, and I still would have wanted to hear more. Due to this being a slightly longer interview, I have separated this episode into two parts. So, welcome to part one. I'd like to introduce my guest on today's show, Matt Bishop. Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Oh, thanks so much for joining me. I know you're fitting me in between meetings, so I really, really appreciate it.
That's a pleasure.
Now, I normally start at the beginning, but you have such a deep family history. I feel like even if we started to delve into your family, we'd be here for 3 hours. So I'm going to go straight away and talk about what was the point, I suppose, in your life where you took an interest in motorsport?
Well, I'll tell you exactly when. I was always a petrol head, not that we called it a petrol head back in the day, but I was one of those nerdy kids that would, you know, walk along or toddle along the pavement, the sidewalk with my mum, and I would point out all the cars that there were and I'd name them. I mean, I'm talking about when I was three. You know, of course, it dates me, the kind of cars that there were. So Austin Cambridge, Morris Oxford, Wolsey Hornet, wow. Riley Elf, all these now long defunct British cars, which I would just name. And my mum was astonished that I did, but I did, because there was no interest really in cars in my family at all. And I was interested in football, played a lot of football, as lots of British kids do. And kids all over the world, but, you know, certainly British kids, and particularly in those days, British boys. And so I had a weekly magazine called Shoot, which was a weekly magazine for kids, football fans. And I went to the newsagent one day, I think I would have been about 9 or 10, and to pick up my copy of Shoot. And when I got there, I saw a magazine on the newsagent's counter, which I'd never seen before. And it was called Autosport, and it had an extraordinary-looking car on the front. Didn't look like a Morris Oxford or an Austin Cambridge or a Riley Elf or a Wolsey Hornet, I can tell you that. It was, in fact, I later learned, Jackie Stewart's Tyrrell, which was a Formula One car, and I had never heard of Formula One. You have to remember, in those days, I mean, I was born in 62, so this would have been 72, and in those days, Formula One wasn't really even on the television. The British Grand Prix was on the television and sometimes the Monaco Grand Prix and just occasionally the Italian Grand Prix. But normally it wasn't on the television, nor was it reported in newspapers. You might just get a very, very small report in, you know, 4-point typeset at the back alongside the croquet and the bowls. A real minority sport. And then you wouldn't get a report. You'd just get number one, Emerson Fittipaldi, brackets, Lotus Ford. Number two, Francois Savaire, brackets, Tyrrell Ford. Number three, Jackie X, brackets, Ferrari. That's it. You wouldn't get four, five, and six. You wouldn't get pole position. You wouldn't get the fact that Ronnie Peterson had led the first 42 laps until his Cosworth blew. None of that. Wow. So it was a completely different world. And in this utterly connected world where we live on our phones and we, you know, are completely connected via social media, it is difficult for young people to quite imagine how you could be a petrol head living in the United Kingdom, in London, and get to the age of 10 without ever having seen a Formula One car. But that was the case.
Yeah.
So I fell in love with just the look of this extraordinary car. And I said to the newsagent, can I swap, shoot for Autosport now? And he said, of course you can, son. So I was then an Autosport reader and I took it home, devoured it. And I actually thought, this sport must have been invented for me only, because there can be nobody else who would be interested in the idea of not only cars, but racing cars.
Yeah.
I thought it must be me only. I later discovered that it wasn't me only. But that was how I got involved in it. It was a simple, extraordinary moment. And I remember it as an epiphany in my growing up.
That must have been an amazing feeling, because I don't think anyone in you know, Formula One now coming into the sport as a fan would ever feel that it was just for them, because as you mentioned, there wasn't much about it, and now it's literally get live updates in the race on social media. So it's like a completely different world. It's so connected. You, as we mentioned, your family, you came from a line of writers, artists, musicians. How did you eventually go into motorsport as a career?
Yeah, my father and mother, they split up when I was two, and my brother was about four or five months old. So my father was the music side, still is, by the way. He's alive today, age 80. Wow. Actually, he will turn 81 in a couple of days. But and he's still playing the piano as a concert pianist. Stephen Kovosevich, actually his name, not Stephen Bishop, for complicated reasons. You know, he did start performing as Stephen Bishop, but now Stephen Kovosevich over the last many years. Anyway, that was him and music via him. But obviously he wasn't part of, he was around, but he wasn't, they'd split up, and I was brought up by my mum. And my mother comes from a rich vein of literary ancestors. So she was a novelist. She wrote five novels, brilliant novels, I have to say. Yeah. And if anybody wants to read one of my mother's novels, Bernadine Bishop is her name. And I think there are five, but the one I would recommend is Hidden Knowledge. Hidden Knowledge is a remarkable book. Anyway, there you are. Plug for my mother, who has passed away, sadly. But so that's her. But my grandmother, her mother was a novel. She wrote eight novels. And my great-great-grandmother, Alice Mennell, was a poet and a suffragist. And her husband, my great-great-grandfather, was a journalist and editor, and it goes on. So I was brought up to love books, to read voraciously, and to revere literature. And as such, cars and Formula One were regarded as, you know, really not the thing. Nothing wrong with it, but, you know, not the thing. And when I was supposed to be studying for my O-levels, which is the magazine, is the, you know, the O-levels, which are now GCSEs, which is the exam that you take when you're 16 type of thing, I would be reading Autosport instead. My mum, I remember her saying to me, stop reading that stupid magazine. That will never help you in your future. You must study your Latin. And God bless her, but I think she was mistaken. I think that the following years, you know, the 40-odd or 40-something years since then have shown that reading Autosport was more useful to me than studying Latin. But that's the way the cookie has crumbled. It was, the one thing I did know, though, is that I loved reading and found that I could write and express myself. And that's still the case. You know, I'm one of those people, if you ask me to write 2,000 words, I can just sit down and write it very quickly. And it comes out at a, you know, whether or not it's any good or not is not for me to say, but I can do it to publishing quality in quite a quick time. And so I realized that maybe the way to combine my passion for cars and motorsport with whatever ability I may have in any area, because I knew I wasn't going to be quick enough to race cars, was to write about them. So that took me into journalism, I suppose.
Yeah. And you went into F1 Racing magazine. You almost changed, I guess, how F1 was reported on as well, because as you said before, in the 70s and such, it wasn't as easy to get results. But not only that, but you kind of, I guess, brought an entertainment value to F1 that probably wasn't really there prior, because you were suddenly reporting on things that, you know, more about the drivers and how they got to where they were. And I don't know if I can put this on you, but I also think you brought a little bit of glamour to the F1 world because you hired photographers such as Darren Heath, and you're shooting photos of drivers very differently. I know I'm putting a lot of pressure on you here, but do you think that is where it kind of shifted F1?
So, look, my first journalism was for Car Magazine, the magazine that is called Car Magazine that exists. And I love cars and I wrote about cars and did road tests and all that kind of thing. But then I was headhunted to become the editor of F1 Racing very, very soon, only a few months after it was launched in 1996. And the thing I quickly realized is that Car Magazine was about cars, but F1 Racing Magazine was about people. And ultimately, however much of a petrol head you may be, people are more interesting than cars. Certainly to write about. You try interviewing a car. So, and Formula One drivers are nervily brilliant people and fascinating to interview. You see them in extremis, human frailty in the raw, genius and ambition in front of your very eyes. And I suppose one of the things that I did, but no, not on my own, absolutely, with brilliant people, you mentioned Darren Heath, great photographer, the best photographer in Formula One at that time, and perhaps if he was still in Formula One, the best photographer in Formula One still, but he's not. He's in New Zealand. COVID prevents him from traveling the world. Not. I don't mean he's got COVID. I mean
no. I know. Yeah, the COVID world.
Yes, the world of COVID. So, brilliantly artistic photographer who broke the mold. And I wanted to showcase his art, and I use that word advisedly, his art, on the pages of F1 Racing. You have to remember F1 Racing came out when there was no such thing, really. I mean, websites were just about beginning, but not really. Nobody really went to them as compared with a magazine. And, of course, there was no social media at all. And I also hired, you know, great writers like the late Alan Henry, much missed, brilliant writer and a great friend, great help to me in my early days, wonderful man who passed away a few years ago. Peter Windsor, still a good friend. Tom Clarkson, still a good friend and well known to Formula One fans for his excellent Beyond the Grid podcast on the official Formula One channel, and many more. So as I'd said earlier, I think when I fell in love with the sport in the early 70s, it wasn't really reported. The next stage was that it began to be reported, but I use that verb carefully. It was reported. So there would be, you know, 10 paragraphs in the Daily Mail saying this is how Niki Lauda won the Dutch Grand Prix. That's what it would say. It wouldn't go into a huge amount of detail and it wouldn't go into the backstory. And then it became, of course, on television all the time. So there really wasn't a need for a newspaper race report, and certainly not a weekly magazine race report in my beloved Autosport either, because you'd already seen it. You'd seen it with your own eyes on the television. Murray Walker had commentated on it for you. Yeah. So you really didn't need that weekly report, and you certainly didn't need a monthly report, which was, of course, F1 Racing was a monthly. So I think we stuck the race reports just as kind of data panels with a little bit of explanatory text right at the back as a kind of digest. But the magazine was all about the beauty of photography, this most photogenic of sports, looking absolutely fabulous across a double page spread. And wordsmith writers, I would use that term, wordsmith writers. And we used to talk about style, access, and authority. The style that was provided by the beautiful graphic design and Darren's great photographs, also, by the way, other photographs by other people like Stephen T, Lorenzo Belanca, Charles Coates, other great photographers that we began to incorporate. And the words by Alan Henry, Peter Windsor, Tom Clarkson. Myself, I used to write as well. I was always a writing editor, and I always think it's better to be a writing editor than just an editing editor. And one of the things we wanted to show, that was the style. The style, that was both style of words and style of look and feel. Access. The point of that was to show that, you know, it wasn't just, you weren't just reading a piece that was the result of the F1 racing journalist sitting in a press conference and recording the quotes and then knitting them into a feature. No, we had acquired and arranged one-to-one access, one-to-one exclusive access. And we might be sitting down at a race to do that interview with Michael Schumacher or Damon Hill or Mika Häkkinen or whoever, or we might have gone to their home, or we might have gone water skiing with them, or we might have played tennis with them. Any one of those kind of things. And we would do that to show that we were actually telling the backstory. And also because you would get them to open up more. Because racing drivers typically are quite het up and quite highly strung during a Grand Prix weekend at a racetrack. Yeah. But if they're sitting at home or sitting in a restaurant away from that time, sometimes they relax and open up. Or if you're playing tennis with them or going water skiing with them, they're actually having fun. And we used to include photographs of ourselves deliberately. People used to think it was egotism. Probably somebody watching this will not believe me when I say that it really wasn't. The point was, if we showed Tom Clarkson playing tennis with Juan Pablo Montoya, or we showed me sitting in a restaurant with Giancarlo Fisichella, the reason was to show that the person whose words they were reading had got those words and was bringing those insights exclusively, one-to-one, having sat down and got them all from the horse's mouth, from the driver himself.
Yeah.
So that's why we did that. And then authority, style, access, and authority. I've talked about authority. We just wanted to make sure that what we were saying was wise, sophisticated, and by and large, right.
And F1 has always seemed to me, definitely my lifetime, a kind of closed off community. Was this purely just created, I guess, to open up the doors to fans and spectators to say, like, this is the real life of F1?
Absolutely. I mean, you could say that F1 racing was Instagram on paper in Formula One back in the day. You know, we all know if you're a Formula One fan, you follow drivers on Instagram and you get an insight into their lives. Same as if you're a soccer fan or a tennis fan, whatever you do, you follow Rafa Nadal and then you'll find out about Rafa Nadal. And that's what we did. But of course, social media didn't exist. So we wanted, if you like, to provide Instagram on paper, not that we called it that at the time.
Yeah.
But F1 Racing was Instagram on paper for Formula One.
And you actually didn't just interview drivers and get this behind-the-scenes scoops of drivers. There's actually a great story where you had sources, inside sources, that told you about a two-brake system that McLaren was doing. Do you mind sharing a bit of that story?
Yeah, it's a long story, so I won't talk about it hugely. But it was it was a collaboration by me and Darren Heath, the great photographer. And Darren Heath should get the credit for this, by the way. So in a nutshell, briefly, in the 1997 Austrian Grand Prix, Darren brought his photographs back and he noticed that the two McLarens had glowing rear brake discs on the exit of a corner, actually a third gear left-hander, the Niki Lauda curve of the A1 ring. And he called me over and said, look at these pictures. Rear brakes only glowing, not fronts, which is rare. And I'm telling you, Matt, this is at an acceleration point, the exit of the corner. Why on earth would the brakes be working? And we stared at it, and I said, it must be the entry. He said, Matt, it isn't. It's the exit. I promise you. So we were flummoxed. Anyway, we did some digging, and we got some sources. Not within McLaren, by the way.
Yeah.
And I still won't say who, even though it is 24 years later. Isn't that amazing? I think the point about Formula One is it's a small world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been in it a long time. And hopefully people would regard me as an honest broker and a trustworthy person. And therefore, if a confidence is given to you, it doesn't expire. Yeah. And I was told what was going on by somebody 24 years ago, and I'm not going to break confidence now. But I can say what he said. I just won't say who said it.
Yeah.
And it was explained to me that there is a two-brake system. They have two brakes. They have the normal brake in McLaren, but they also have a brake that reduces understeer and wheel spin by trimming the car. And it's switchable to the left or the right. So if you're coming into a left-hander, you manually switch with your hand to make this extra brake only work on the left rear. And that just reduces the understeer and tucks the car in. And it was very effective. Entirely legal. Entirely legal. It became afterwards a big bone of contention, and a Ferrari got it banned, but not until the following year.
Yeah.
Anyway, we knew what it was, but we wanted to find out how to report it. So the next race was at Nürburgring. And I said to Darren, I'm going to be watching the television. You're going to be out on the track. And if either of these McLarens stops, break down, remember that breakdowns were far more common in those days. Cars' engines blew quite frequently. Then I'll tell you what turn that's happened, and you zoom down there. And he blagged a paddock scooter from Jordan, actually, I believe, and he was waiting. Anyway, it so happened that the two McLarens in first and second place, both their engines failed at the end of the main straight. So Darren absolutely zoomed down there, got there, saw the two abandoned McLarens within walking distance of each other. David Coulthard had put his steering wheel back in, which is a regulation that you must. But in his frustration, Mika Häkkinen, who had been leading the race, did not. He did not put his steering wheel back in, which enabled Darren, quickly before the marshals got to the car, to be able to get his camera right down into the footwell, which he wouldn't have been able to do with a steering wheel in. So there's a lot of luck here. We needed the car to break down, and we needed Mika not to do what the regulations demand that he should have done. So he put his camera down into the footwell. And remember, we're talking about film now, not digital.
Yeah.
So he was just blind, photographing blind, click, 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 bracketing, changing the exposure, trying to make sure that he was getting what he hoped he was getting, and the focus was right, autofocus, getting it all correct. Of course, we didn't see the films until, you know, about 12 hours later, when he brought them back to the UK. We got them processed in London, and we had one picture that was absolutely perfect.
Wow.
That showed the accelerator pedal, main brake pedal, secondary brake pedal. And then we were able to write a story. Here is the brake pedal. And here is proof of it working, because you have a car with its inside rear brake discs glowing on the exit of a corner. And that was a remarkable thing. That made Darren Heath's name, and it didn't do me any harm either, because for a monthly magazine to be able to scoop the world is quite a feat, quite a feat. And when we came out with that story, we were the only ones who had it, and it caused an absolute storm. Ferrari, in the end, did get the system banned next year. Ron Dennis was extremely upset and annoyed. He couldn't understand how we'd got the story, but we did. Yeah. And at that point, I certainly didn't think that I would end up being a director of McLaren. But but guess what I did? You know, people forgive and forget. At that time, Ron was not in a forgiving frame of mind.
That was actually going to be my question, is you mentioned how Ron Dennis was quite disappointed with it. Not disappointed, but obviously quite shocked that you were able to get all of that information and it all worked out. And you also talked about confidence and how it's really important no matter how many years on you have that confidence. as a journalist and an editor, where's the fine line between keeping those good relationships but also getting the scoop?
It's a very good question. It is an eternal quandary for the journalist and indeed for people in teams. When I was a journalist, if somebody came to me and said, "Thank you for that interview, that was very good, I liked it," I used to say, "That's very kind of you, and I'm glad you liked it, but please bear in mind that, you know, that is a detail, and I'm glad you liked it, but there may be another time when I write something that you will not like, because that's how journalism is."
Yeah.
And they used to sometimes be surprised that I would say that. I'll say, "But you've done a brilliant job this year, so we've been writing very nicely about you. And by the way, you more usually write about the people who are doing well anyway, because that's what you're interested in."
Yeah.
So you'd more likely do, I'll go back in the day so as not to offend any of the current protagonists, but you'd more likely write about Mika Häkkinen than Ricardo Rosset, let's say. The same thing would apply today. But occasionally you would also have to criticize people, and they were shocked. And the most famous occasion of that in my career was when I criticized, we were doing a photo shoot with Ralf Schumacher. And he was having a bad year. It was 2007. He was at Toyota. And he was being outpaced by his teammate, Jarno Trulli. And we were doing a photo shoot in Indianapolis, actually. We'd repurposed a spare Bridgestone garage as a photographic studio. And we had, there were more budgets in those days. Formula One was easier. There was more available money. And there's still plenty of money. But for the media, for magazines, there was money. Because advertising was big. So we had a portrait photographer with a million cameras and an assistant, and we'd flown him out there. Great stuff. Anyway, Ralph said, he's standing there looking at the camera, and then he suddenly stopped and said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to do this unless you can, if you continue to write negatively about me. I've decided, I've changed my mind. I'm only going to do this if you write positively about me and the team." So I was there. The photographer kind of stared at me as if to say, "What do we do now?" I said, "Ralph, I'm really sorry, but it doesn't work like that. You know, this is a photo shoot, but we have a contract with our readers without whom the magazine wouldn't exist, and for whom we produce it, and they pay for it. So obviously, we have to tell it like we see it. It's called journalistic editorial integrity. You could call it readers' rights." But we have to tell it as we see it. And I'm sorry to say, obviously, we have criticized you this year because Jarno has been quicker than you. So I'm afraid, that is the way of it. We don't need to do it out of rudeness. It's just the way it is. So he said, "No, in that case, I won't do the photo shoot." I said, "Well, in that case, that maybe has to be how it is. If you don't want to do the photo shoot, I can't force you." He said, "No, you must write positively." And I slightly lost it. What I wanted to say really was, our adherence to editorial journalistic integrity or readers' rights is non-negotiable. What is negotiable is whether or not you want to do this photo shoot. If you do not want to do it, please leave. I slightly used a more ribald phrase for "please leave." And he did leave.
Yeah.
And that, I suppose, was an unusual set of the circumstances because that was a breakdown in a relationship. Hmm. Funnily enough, Jarno Trulli was the next driver that we had to photograph, and he found it absolutely hilarious. So, teammates are not always mates, let's put it that way.
I can imagine there'd be lots of egos and things as well in Formula One. As you said, there's a lot going on in a driver's mind. And for Ralph, I'm sure it would have been really difficult with, his brother and everything else. So I can only imagine he any bad publicity would just make that even harder to take.
By the way, I'll just say something about Ralph. Ralph now works in the media. He works for Sky Deutschland, and he's in the paddock every race. He was a fine driver. He was in the shadow of his brother, and that was through no fault of his own. Yeah. And, sometimes people say, you completely fell out with Ralf Schumacher. Yes, I did then. But, that is 14 years ago. If I see Ralf Schumacher in the paddock, we say hello.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess you were probably not the only one either, probably saying slightly negative things about his racing. I'm sure there were other people as well. So I'm sure he can forgive and forget. But on that note, you left F1 Racing Magazine in 2007. Were you really proud of where you left it? I know things were changing in 2007. And as you mentioned, like obviously now the internet exists and things are changing. Were you really proud of the team and where you had left it when you left?
I was very, very proud of everybody at F1 Racing. I think we had achieved something very special, but, you know, I will take no credit. It was an absolute team effort. You know, when I joined F1 Racing as editor in 1996, it was on sale in one language in one country, the United Kingdom. By the time 11 years later I left it, it was on sale in 34 languages in 110 countries.
Wow.
And that was a big business success. It was money-making. It was dominant in the field of the written word in Formula One. And everybody had to read it, everybody. So that was great fun. But, you know, it was because of the success of the people I hired who were brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I've named them already, and there were others besides. But I thought that the internet was beginning to supersede print as the way in which anything really, news, sport, art, etc., would be consumed. And although I obviously, you know, I'm on Twitter and I read websites as much as anybody else, for me, I was a bit old school, and crafting a beautiful magazine that sat on the coffee table and looked nice seemed to be something that might become a dying art, certainly in terms of something that could be monetized. So I had begun to have the odd offer from teams to join, you know, in a comms or PR capacity. And during about late 2006, early 2007, I began to think the next good one I might take. And I had had a few and they hadn't been right. But then along came Spygate in 2007, where McLaren was found to have illicit possession of Ferrari IP, which became a huge scandal and eventuated in a $100 million fine for McLaren, which they paid. It was a big mess. And Ron Dennis asked me to join as communications director. He had very good staff, but he didn't have any strategic communication directors. And he needed someone, A, he knew and trusted, and B, who really did know the Formula One media landscape and knew the people who were causing trouble for him, Ron, which was primarily Max Mosley, president of the FIA at the time, and also obviously Bernie Ecclestone, commercial rights holder at the time. And I knew both Max and Bernie. I mean, I knew Max very well. I've never been to a party with him, I'll just tell you that, or a dungeon. But I did know him very well. In fact, I commissioned him to write 12 columns one year for F1 Racing, and I interviewed him often.
Yeah.
Interviewed and spoke to Bernie Ecclestone not quite as often, but often. And, of course, Ron knew them both as well, but he knew them in an antagonistic way. He didn't know them in any way of a matey way. And if you really, I think it'd be fair to say he didn't really, particularly Max, he didn't know how Max ticked. And maybe just a little bit, I was able to assist there. So yes, Ron hired me. It was too late to do anything about Spygate. The $100 million fine was levied and paid. But going forward, I was just one of a group of people at McLaren, obviously Ron Dennis, Martin Whitmarsh, who I now work with again at Aston Martin, but you may come to that. We had the task of trying to rebuild that brand. You know, McLaren, a brilliant brand then and now, but it was in trouble. And we did do that. And that was a great challenge and a great excitement. And of course, you know, the rest is history. I worked there for 10 years and it was a great time.
On the next episode of The Female Drive, I continue my interview with Matt Bishop, as we go into part two. If you enjoyed part one, make sure you tune in to part two, as it only gets better from here.